Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Dr. Branko Milanovic is a visiting presidential professor at the Graduate Center City University of New York and a senior scholar at the Stone Center of Socioeconomic Inequality. He served as a lead economist in the World Bank's research department for almost 20 years, leaving to write his seminal book on global income inequality, Worlds Apart, in 2005. He has also been associated with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington and has held teaching appointments at the University of Maryland and at the Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Milanovic's main area of work is income inequality in individual countries and globally, including in pre-industrial societies. In addition to numerous papers for the World Bank, he has published widely. His book, The Haves and the Have-Nots, was selected by The Globalist as the 2011 Book of the Year. His new book, Global Inequality, was awarded the Bruno Kreisky Prize for the Best Political Book of 2016. In October 2017, he was awarded, jointly with Mariana Mazzucato, the 2018 Leontief Prize for Advancing the Frontiers of Economic Knowledge. He has just published a new book entitled Capitalism Alone. Branko, thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this podcast. We are honored to have you as our guest. In addition to being a prolific writer on the subject of income inequality, you're also an excellent teacher, a master communicator of complex ideas. I remember, in fact, one of your talks, I believe it was at the World Bank, in which you explained that if you lined up the entire world's population, all 7.5 billion of us, from poorest to richest, with the likes of Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and other super rich men at one end, and the poorest of the poor at the other, you needed something like 75% of the world's population to generate 20% of global income. Please, to get this discussion started, share with our non-specialized audience two or three such other examples to give us a sense of the extent and the pervasiveness of income inequality in the world today.
It's a very good question. I would, let me give you, for example, one example that comes to mind, like right now, is that we are generally not able to visualize in our minds, essentially, how big inequalities are. Because, you know, our experience, whether we are poor, middle class, or rich, is that we meet more or less people who are relatively close to us. You know, we meet some people who are poor, we meet some people who are richer, and we somehow implicitly believe that the distribution is what is called, normal distribution. There are some people above you, some people below you in terms of income. But in reality, when you put them, as you said, actually in that example, put everybody together, I would use a sort of a simile that was proposed by the Dutch economist Jan Pen, is if you had actually people height reflect their income level or wealth, and if you had to have a parade where you stand like in these old-fashioned parades where, you know, the Soviet leadership would stand in front on the Kremlin and then people would march there. And let's suppose that the parade lasts 60 minutes. What would happen is that for about, 20 minutes of that, you would have people who are sort of at the level of the ground, or they are really just little bit above ground, they are almost like midgets, and they will be parading there because their incomes are really so small that they would be way below the average height of a person or the average income of the person. And then, of course, eventually, it's only around the 40th minute of the parade that a person with the normal height would appear, which would be the person like with mean income. And then it would be really very, very tall people, like, you know, basketball players, like several times basketball players, like 10 times basketball players. And then at the very end would come people that you mentioned by name, you know, the billionaires and others. So that would be in the last maybe 20 seconds. But we would actually not even be able to see them because their height is so enormous, they would be basically touching the clouds. So that's how the income distribution is. Or let me give you another example similarly. That was actually one that was used by Nassim Taleb to make also people understand the fact that the income distribution is what is called asymmetrical. In other words, that actually there are people whose income or wealth are so enormous that it's very difficult to conceive of that. His example is as follows. He said he was once at a conference in Las Vegas. That was a conference of the obese people of the United States. Okay, so there were very many, you know, big people weighing a lot. And so then there was the elevator. And he said, well, you know, elevators are built on the assumption, of course, that they could have really very obese, very heavy people, and they would still be able to move you from the, you know, ground floor to whatever floor you wanted to go. So, there is like an extra precaution built there that the elevator would not collapse. So he said, look at that. There was an elevator, for example, for 10 people. And however these 10 people might have been obese at that conference, there was no doubt that the elevator would work. But he said then, imagine that now the weight represents your income. Well, you cannot be sure anymore. It may not be a conference of the richest people in the world. Let's suppose it's like an ordinary, you know, sort of conference of an investment group. You would actually have people who, if the average wealth is represented by a person of average weight, you would have people like Jeff Bezos who, if they were to happen to walk into the elevator, that elevator would crash because their weight would be millions of tons. So that's, I think, another way to say that actually what we see in real life are phenomena with which we are sort of conversant and familiar, where the distributions are what is called generally normal, which means that there are as many people on the left or below, as many people to the right or above from the mean, but the distributions of income or wealth are extremely asymmetrical, where the people at the top have incomes and wealth which is, you know, hundreds, thousands, sometimes million times higher than the people at the median.
Very interesting. And I think it's one of the reasons why your books are so much fun to read, Branko, because they're full of these very insightful, interesting examples. There has been some discussion, obviously, in the last 12 months about the impact of COVID-19, for instance, on poverty. The World Bank, our colleagues, the World Bank came up with a report a few months ago, which basically said that as a result of the pandemic, there will be a substantial increase in the incidence of extreme poverty, which is an area in which we have done some progress in the last 30 years. What do you think will be the impact of COVID-19 on income inequality?
Yes, Adolfo, this is a great question. Let me first say that when it comes to poverty, there is, I think, very little doubt that there will be a significant negative impact, increasing poverty, with COVID. You know, it is simply that we have not had actually in certainly in the recorded history after World War II, and I actually would think, I wanted to look recently at Madison's numbers, but I think we never had a decline of the GDP of the world of 3% or 3.5% as we might have had in 2020. It is a huge, you know, decline. I think, for example, we had in 2008, it was 1.5, you know, overall. This year we had actually China growing, but that was at a rate which was lower than it would normally be. And of course, India going down by 10% and all of European Union going down by, you know, single digits, but still bad. and the U.S. by 3%. So we never had something like that. So there is no doubt that the poverty would go up. Now, the question is, what will happen to inequality? There, I think the situation is a little bit more complicated. Angus Deaton recently had a paper arguing, I think quite persuasively, that global inequality would actually, how should I say, the decline of global inequality would stop this year and could even be slightly reversed. That was based on two underlying elements. The first one is that richer countries have had a larger decline in real income, which of course would mean in principle that you would have a convergence. However, large countries like India have had a very bad outcome, and South Africa as well. And so that, and Brazil. So that essentially would mean that the gap between them and some of the rich countries would increase in terms of real income. On top of that, and that's a very important element, which is not due only to COVID, but COVID has accelerated that. So I really want to people to understand that. I'll try to explain it. The role of China has fundamentally changed over the last 5 or even 10 years. China was a huge force for the reduction of global inequality. But as China becomes richer, it moves closer to the obviously richer countries. It becomes upper income, middle income country, then upper income country. And it pulls further away from countries like, you know, Sudan, Ethiopia, Nigeria, India, Indonesia, Vietnam. I'm intentionally putting all the large countries with lots of people. So China no longer really contributes to the reduction of global inequality. Its growth rate now is about like zero effect global inequality. And that's something that was coming. Now, as Deaton says, it has been sort of accelerated by COVID-19 because China had a pretty, relatively good outcome there. So the bottom line is the following. I think for global inequality, it seems that we would have practically no change this year, which is different from the past when we had really more or less continued decline in global inequality. But the more important message is that we cannot rely on China anymore to do the job of reducing global inequality. And that means the implication of that is the role of India becomes now crucial, and the role of African catch-up becomes really in the longer term or in the medium term even more important. So this would be my message, which is really not driven as much by COVID, although COVID has, as I said before, has accelerated that development.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you. That's a very, very clear explanation. As you know, in sort of late 2019, many countries in Latin America experienced massive social unrest. Even in Chile, which is the country in the region with perhaps the best track record for poverty reduction, sound fiscal management, the highest credit ratings, and so on. Is it an exaggeration to say that lack of attention to inequality can undermine the basis of democracy? And over time, if we don't address it, if it's allowed to persist, the entire social fabric?
Glad that you mentioned the case of Chile. I got involved a little bit on the social media with Chile because, you know, Chile has always had had also after Pinochet, at first had negative press politically, but really positive press throughout economically. And then when Chile became democracy, it was assumed really only the positive, nice sides prevailed. And it was driven, as you said, by fairly good indicators in many respects. But these good indicators were always average indicators. And this is one of the issues that we, I think, always face. It's inevitable in some sense. We really focus on what is the average income, what is the growth rate, which growth rate is the average, of course, average number. We focus on what are the, you know, transparency ratings and so on. But what is underneath, I think, Chile, that I think became to some extent clear with the demonstrations and dissatisfaction, was that significant parts of the population were really left out. And when I looked at global inequality, and that became quoted in the Chilean press, you know, the very top 5% of the Chilean population had incomes of the 5% of richest Germans. So whether you're the richest 5% in Chile or Germany, you're the same in real income. The bottom 5% of people in Chile had the same income as the bottom 5% of people in Mongolia. So if you have that situation, something is clearly out of whack. And I think that has, of course, been shown in Chile because, as you know, the original reason for the, or the pretext or the, for the demonstrations was a relatively minor one. It was the increase in the fares of the buses and metro. But it really provoked massive outpouring of dissatisfaction. And I think that underneath that was the issue that we as economists have to deal with, that we focus on average measures and we don't focus on measures that are about heterogeneity. Obviously, in income inequality, wealth inequality are the measures about heterogeneity. Last point on Chile, I want also to mention, Chile is a country with extremely high inequality of wealth. It's one of the top countries in the share of billionaires compared to their GDP. And finally, it had, of course, a billionaire as a president, so which is probably not an accident when you end up as a president, as a billionaire. And so I think these are all the interesting features of Chile, which were revealed precisely because of the unrest which happened in the country.
And do you think that therefore, if a serious problem of inequality can be a risk factor for the stability of democracy?
I do think so. And, you know, obviously you can say to me that I'm not unbiased in that because obviously everybody tries to make whatever he's studying or she's studying more relevant and more important. So I do understand that actually I may be biased in that. But let me then skip the example of Chile. Let's look, for example, at the United States and the rise of Trump. Or let's look at France and Gilets Jaunes and, on the other hand, Le Pen. You know, I think all these movements are movements which are driven not necessarily because the Gini coefficient went up, although in the United States, of course, it did. But in France, it didn't. Actually, France is a country where you didn't have an increase in inequality. But they are driven by the disregard of, by the elites of a certain segment of the population that were really adversely affected by globalization or technological change. And these are the people, and when you look, for example, at France, you see that in northeastern France, where actually we choose to be very industrialized of the industries that are now being sort of essentially outsourced and being done elsewhere, that's where the largest discontent was. So I think it is the inequality often which appears as a polarization in terms of income, chances of success, opportunities in life, hopes, ability of children from such families to actually accede to the higher positions. So I think all of that together, it is not necessarily a Gini coefficient. As I said before, France or Belgium did not have an increase, but I think there is definitely a sort of social malaise which is driven by that kind of inequality. Or unfairness also, if you want to call it differently.
Branko, in thinking about sort of the instruments that we can use to address the problem of inequality, you know, for instance, in my case, I have often spoken about how subsidizing energy is a very regressive measure because the IMF has demonstrated that 60% of the benefit of the energy subsidies goes to the 20 top percent of the income distribution. From your own perspective, what are the sort of the instruments in your toolbox? Are there any low-hanging fruit? Are there things that are not being done that could make a difference or things that we are doing that make the problem worse?
You know, I tried at the very end of capitalism alone to be very succinct because I think that the tools that we have are well known And we could actually reduce inequality over a period of time. You know, we're not talking to reducing inequality tomorrow, but if you implement, I'll come in a second to some policies, definitely the results will be observable within 5 years, I'd say. Now, what are these tools? I actually wanted to divide them into three categories in order to explain what is the logic behind them. They are first the tools which would deal with labor. In other words, the tools which would deal with, you know, more equal distribution of labor income. They are the most important tool is education and equal access to high quality education. Like I'm using the example of the United States the most because I know it, where basically private education has become a monopoly which serves only the children of the rich. And we see that from the empirical data that finally we have been able to extract from Harvard and Yale and others who actually didn't want to release this data for years, which shows essentially that the ratio between likelihood of somebody who is the top 1% and somebody who is in the middle class is 60-1. In likelihood of a children of a top 1%er being in school is 60 times higher than the likelihood of parents who are in the middle class in the U.S. of sending the kids to these schools. Now, that immediately produces a huge difference down the road because these schools generate, of course, they may be better educationally, but certainly they're much better in terms of impression that they give on potential employers and the wages that these people can command down the road. So really the emphasis on public education is crucial there. Then when it comes to labor, there are other issues like trade unions, which actually very often cannot organize or it's very difficult for them to organize. You can see now with Amazon, they're trying to do it. And the minimum wage. So these would be the issues there. And then, of course, we come to taxation of very high incomes, where I'm not actually arguing from some extravagant taxes, but actually simply the taxes which would be at certainly below 50% on the marginal tax rate, but higher than what is now. Then we come to capital. There it's actually more difficult because capital is very heavily concentrated. And there you have several tools as well. You would have advantages to be paid or given to small investors and actually taking away advantages that are currently being enjoyed by the large investors. So that would make the distribution of capital broader. It is really essentially the idea is what James Mead had of property owning democracy. So this is basically the idea. How do we distribute capital much more broadly? And then you have employee stock ownership plans. That's another thing that which where workers would get shares. Then you can have a possibility that Tony Atkinson suggested of giving grants to the young people at the beginning of their career, which could be funded through taxation. And finally, equalization of taxation between capital and labor. And the third sort of axis of action is on the political sphere, political campaigns, and inability of the rich to fund the political campaigns, public funding of the campaigns, and also limits on the ability of people to, you know, go between the private and public sectors. We had yesterday the discussion on social media about, for example, Janet Yellen receiving $6 million in, like, I think 2 or 3 years from speeches. That's legal, obviously, but is it ethical? I think it's very doubtful. I mean, you cannot be at the same time in favor of reduction of inequality and have such obvious use of previous political power. So these are actually three axes, you know. One is, as I said again, labor, another one capital, and the third one is political campaigns.
What do you think about universal basic income? I myself have been unpersuaded by the argument that it would reduce incentives for work and have often said that we need to have an honest debate about the issue of affordability, given the massive waste of budgetary resources in, you know, many areas like energy subsidies, military spending, and so on. And I feel very uncomfortable with an economic system where whether you're born in Norway or Angola has radically different implications for your average life expectancy, the likelihood of malnutrition, and more generally, equality of opportunity. So So I'm very curious to know, what does Branko Milanović think about universal basic income?
Let me just first say that, of course, the gaps between Norway and Angola will, of course, remain even with, UBI, because, of course, these will be country-wide programs in principle. So this issue of differences in incomes between the countries and markedly different life chances are, of course, enormous. And, I've made very often a point that many people from the rich and relatively equal countries like the Nordic countries of Europe have, even at the bottom of their income distribution, incomes which are higher than incomes of people in African countries at the top. So, that inequality is enormous, and, it would remain. Now, when it comes to UBI within countries, it's a difficult topic. In capitalism alone, I was at least skeptical towards it. I thought actually it cannot run at the same time with welfare state, simply because welfare state is, lots of money is going there. And the principles upon which a welfare state was based were different. The principle of the welfare state, as you know, is insurance. And it is insurance when you are, when you are, for example, pregnant and have kids, cannot work. It's insurance when you are sick. It's insurance when you lose your job and then you get unemployment benefit. So the principle of that was citizenship and insurance. Citizenship then kicks in when you have social assistance, which actually is given to somebody who has not been able to get any assistance on any other grounds. UBI does away with all of that and in principle gives everybody that minimum, which will be sufficient to, have some reasonable life. So there are other issues there. I will not go over them. I've got four of them that I was actually, which led my skepticism. Including, for example, that the people on the right are very much in favor of UBI simply because they say, well, once we get all taxed and give everybody UBI, so don't come back to ask us about further increases in inequality, because basically we gave you the money and you should, maybe go to the beach and, sit there and not complain. People on the left actually believe UBI would be useful because I'm going to pitch the tax rate so high that I would be able to pay people quite a lot and also tax the rich a lot as well. So they are really incompatible objectives of the left and right, which of course makes you wonder if such a program would ever really sort of satisfy the both constituencies. I had, unlike you, a little bit of a problem with possibility of people actually not working. We have very few experiments. We have really very limited experiments with UBI and never at a countrywide level. We had it at, sub-country and even, county levels. And so we really don't know. However, I have to say that I have slightly revised my opinion because of COVID. Now, let me explain that. With COVID, for example, you take the United States, you take Europe. If we had UBI, we would not have to go through all these legislative processes of different stimuli, which were actually, voted and always led to horse trading among politicians, who will going to get what, what companies, how much to the corporate sector, how much to the individuals. We would have a system which would be an automatic system that would guarantee incomes to everybody. So what would have happened with the UBI under the conditions of COVID would be that the take-up of the UBI would actually shoot up. So there will be much more money being spent on that, but it will be an automatic stabilizer, if you will, and there will be no need for legislative action. So that is something that I have not considered in capitalism alone, but I see now as a significant advantage of UBI.
Thank you. Most interesting. I think that COVID-19 is actually leading people like you and others to rethink our positions on many of these issues. And I'm very encouraged to hear you say that you are more positive about UBI than was the case before. In one of your books, you examine the kind of contradiction between a world in which ideas, knowledge, communication, awareness of the living standards of Swedes, Germans, and Americans have become fully globalized and coexist simultaneously with increasing differences in average incomes among countries and restrictions to the movement of people across national boundaries. I think you called it a trilemma, if I remember correctly. How do we address this problem? Because the problem hasn't gone away since you first pointed it out to us a few years ago.
Yes, the problem is not likely to go away because, of course, it is in the setup of globalization. The fact is that globalization takes place in conditions of very uneven incomes between the countries. That has many implications. An obvious one is that outsourcing and imports, outsourcing to poorer countries and imports of poorer countries have an effect on the labor force in rich countries. You know, imagine that you had globalization with countries that are about the same level of income. Let's suppose you have globalization the way that the European Union 15 had. You would not have a massive systemic flows, neither of labor nor capital between the countries, simply because income levels, skill levels, and wages are relatively uniform, relatively close. But when you have globalization taking place at the world scale, where, I mean, by definition, globalization is worldwide, then, of course, you have large differences which enable people to basically invest their money and elsewhere, not in their own country, and actually make more money by sending capital and employing people in countries where wage levels are lower, or differently, importing goods from countries where wage levels are lower. So that itself, of course, creates the problems that we just mentioned. But on top of that, there is the movement of labor, which I, you know, sort of one of the elements of the trilemma, was that you have globalization that has so far involved the movement of goods, which trade, to some extent movement of ideas, because, you know, technological change has been sort of spreading around the world, and even the ideas about the organization of societies. But one factor of production has been really stuck where it is, and this is labor. Total number of percentage of people who are born in countries where they were not, where they don't, born in countries where they don't live now, who are born in other countries than the countries where they live now, it's around 3.5% of the world, and that number has slightly gone up, but it's really relatively small. Compare that with the amount of capital that is actually trans-border, which is in double digits. So that's a big difference. And technically speaking, if we could have a total mobility of labor, that would be good for global inequality and global poverty. We have studies that show that really a significant reduction in global poverty, significant increase in global incomes and so forth. The problem, however, is that, you know, people are not avatars. It's not like we can just move them like we move them on a computer screen. They come with their own opinions, values, and culture. So that oftentimes leads to the problems of assimilation or the acceptance. And they also affect maybe wages of some groups that in which with whom they are competing. They are also, in some cases, actually helping the wages of others when there is complementarity. But nevertheless, this is really, I think, an issue. And I have proposed, I will not go into details of that, but I have proposed sort of something which would be, I called it a sub-citizenship, which would allow people from poorer countries to emigrate to richer countries, but stay there only for a limited period of time with compulsory, obligatory return to their countries of origin, but they would actually make money during these 5 years or so, and they would probably make connections which they would be able to use later. So that's the idea. It's not an ideal solution, and many people have attacked me on that, but I think it is better to have people come to richer countries and make more money and send this to their families than having the current situation where you have, you know, Fortress of Europe, where you have essentially, you know, as you know, boats, you know, making sure that people from Africa and the Middle East cannot, you know, access Europe. You send them back. Many of them die. You know, people forget that the number of deaths on the Mediterranean is multiple times greater than the number of annual deaths that was at the Berlin Wall. We are talking about the range of like maybe 50 times more, or maybe 100. And the same is true between Mexico and the United States. So this is the current world, which is not, in that sense, it's far from ideal.
Branko, let me ask you one final question. Samuel Johnson, 18th century thinker and philosopher, and always ready with an apt quotation, thinking about the lower end of the income distribution, said the following, and I quote, "Poverty is a great enemy of human happiness. It certainly destroys liberty, and it makes some virtues impracticable and others extremely difficult." Do you agree with this? Your books, which is why they are so much fun to read, always have fascinating historical vignettes. Can you share with us, to conclude, one or two of your favorite ones? I seem to remember, for instance, in one of your books, some speculation about who was the richest man in the entire history of humanity. But I'll let you choose your favorite vignettes.
I like that citation by Samuel Johnson. You know, it is, I think, very appropriate. We are economists, and we do believe that, not only because we are economists, you know, I think many political scientists and political philosophers believe that a certain level of income is really necessary for first functioning in society, for being happy, for being satisfied. And people who are desperate and who are poor, actually people who are poor are desperate. You know, there is nothing much for you to lose if you're poor, and if you have no solution or no obvious way of getting out of that. So I agree with, poverty is a scourge. So it is something which really limits our human ability to flourish, to contribute to ourselves, to families, to the society. I know that there are some ascetic people, and I'm actually currently reading, for example, Confucius, who does actually put an emphasis very often on not having, wealth. And it is true that in some instances, wealth is really constraining because it consumes you. The desire to acquire more and more becomes a disease. The greed is one of those things. So both extremes are bad. But as I said, I totally agree with Samuel Johnson that, poverty is really a scourge of, and this is why we really also want to eliminate poverty, let alone that it has huge implications also on health and education and other, characteristics. Now, when you spoke of vignettes, it was kind of hard to come by, immediately. I've got quite a few of them. Many of them are historical from, different historical episodes. You mentioned, for example, who was the richest man in history. I think this was an interesting question. I eliminated everybody who was a political ruler. You know, the problem with political rulers is that you cannot distinguish their own private wealth from the wealth of the state. So then we have really kind of, we can say such and such ruler was the richest, but really the question is actually what is his private and what is his public. Of course, they do the two, they sort of treat both of them interchangeably, but there is a difference between the two. I mean, among other reasons, because very often you cannot take your public wealth with you. I mean, there is an interesting thing here, since you mentioned that. Let me give you, for example, the example of communist rulers. Like, let's say Stalin. Stalin had at a given time about 20 residences, which were all ready to receive him every evening because he didn't want to, to let everybody know where he was going for the evening. He actually mostly went to one of them most of the time, but there were about, I think, about 20 or 15 to 20 that were basically ready. So there's a huge amount of, obviously, of income spent there. You have to have security. You have people preparing meals and all of that. So it really, it's an incredible wealth when you look at this. On the other hand, it's not a wealth that was transmitted. You know, the Stalin's son died in the German POW camp because Stalin didn't want to exchange him for the German marshal that was captured in Stalingrad. So for Stalin's son, it really made no difference. For Stalin's grandson, it made no difference. So that's the difference between public and private. Very often you would have huge amounts of public wealth, but that wealth would actually not be transmittable. So that's why I deleted all the you know, kings, leaders, and others. I mean, take Mao Zedong also, you know, there was nothing much that actually spilled out to the family. I mean, despite the fact that he enjoyed many amenities. But then when you come with that, then you, of course, have the next problem is how do you compare people from different ages? And there I took Adam Smith's, you know, very good idea. We basically, Adam Smith says what we really should do. We should actually, they have one standard with which we can compare, and that standard is human labor. So what was the average cost of human labor at a given time and a given place? And then you ask the question, how many thousands or millions of people can that individual hire in the place and at the time where he lives? And then, of course, you have interesting conclusions. You can actually have data, for example, of Roman incomes, very rich people in Rome, and you have incomes data on wages in Rome. So you can take data from wealth and wages and calculate it. Now, interestingly, it turns out at that time when I did it, that, for example, Carlos Slim, in terms of Mexican labor, was the richest people in history because the Mexican wages are relatively low, and of course Carlos Slim had an enormous wealth. Another, you know, person who also benefited from low wages in his country was Khodorkovsky, the Russian oligarch who was later put in jail by Putin, who also was an incredibly wealthy man in terms of the wages. But if you take in the United States, for example, where of course wages are higher, Rockefeller was, at that time when I did the work, was richer than Gates, simply because his own wealth compared to the wages at his peak, which I think was 1938 or something, his wealth compared to these wages was extremely high. I don't know how it would be now with Bezos, but I think it's a good way to approach the question. So that would be the vignette that you suggested. And I just would like to say another possibility of looking at inequality, which I think is very pregnant and very useful, is to look at what literature gives us, because many 19th century writers, including Jane Austen or Balzac or Tolstoy, would give quite a lot of information about income and wealth of people. And, you know, these numbers are accurate because they were writing at the time, and if they were inaccurate, their readers would actually react to that. So it gives us really quite a lot of possibilities of calculating where different, you know, people were in the income distribution, including, for example, the fact that Elizabeth Bennet was, in terms of her family income, in the top 1% of the English income distribution in around 1810, but Mr. Darcy was like really in 0.1%, and the gap between the two of them was enormous, so much so that I calculated that if she would not marry Mr. Darcy but would go back to the income that would be guaranteed to her after the death of her parents, the ratio was 100-1. So I would suggest from that Elizabeth had quite a high incentive to find Mr. Darcy attractive.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. So very fascinating anecdote. Thank you, Branko, for this enlightening presentation. I think that you make a strong case that we ignore income inequality at a great risk to our future prosperity, and who knows, maybe the stability of our societies. Income inequality is a central area of interest of the Global Governance Forum, and we look forward to future collaboration with you. In the meantime, please continue to educate, to inspire, and to delight your audiences with your excellent, insightful books.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be with you again. I wish it was in vivo, person to person, rather than, this way online, but hopefully soon these times will come back, and I would be very happy to see you and your friends and to continue this very interesting discussion.
Thank you, Branko.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.